accession number 31693, reel 17.
Mr. Robson, reel 17. What annual, is that, if that's the right term, ceremonials did the regiment carry out? Well, the statutory ones, the traditional ones, I should say.
We had the Governor's Guard, although I never took part in that, the Governor of Hong Kong, because one of our officers actually moved as the ADC to the Governor, Captain Sol Townsend. He was my signals officer, and he went off to be the ADC to the Governor, and he later rejoined us as adjutant of the battalion when we went to Borneo. And one of my memories was we did the Queen's Birthday Parade in Hong Kong, and we did it with the Gurkhas, who had the same pace as us, the Royal Navy and various other units which took part. And we, those who took part in the Queen's Birthday Parade, were dressed in whites. And you can imagine what it was like trying to, the way we got, because you didn't get changed in the barracks. We had to travel over in normal uniform and get changed in the stadium and try to keep your uniform whites actually clean before the parade actually getting changed. And my memory was actually doing the rehearsals. And up on the dais was Captain Townsend, who was taking the place. And Captain Townsend was up on the dais, and when I marched past, I gave him a wink, as we not strictly proper, but gave him a wink. He just smiled back, and but I remember on the main parade though. We and the Gurkhas were held back after the main parade to allow everybody else, the RAF, the Welsh Regiment, South Wales Borderers it was, South Wales Borderers, Royal Navy, we had to give them a good half an hour, three quarter an hour start when they marched off. And then when we marched off, of course, we marched off at the light infantry pace, and actually caught them up as they were going into HMS Tamar, which was, I don't know, about 2 or 3 miles away, I think it was. And we marched actually all the way to HMS Tamar, got on the ship there, and went back over to Kowloon, where we were stationed. Many years later, after I came out of the army, and I was in the prison service, and I was a senior officer at down south, and a guy who was ex-Royal Navy said he was actually in Hong Kong at the same time as me, and he took part in the parade and was telling me about this regiment who caught them up going into HMS Tamar. He says there were some light infantry regiment, he said. I says, they were the Durhams. I says, and I was in that parade, and I was in the parade. I was in the Queen's Birthday Parade guard, who actually caught up with us. So we became friends after that. And that was just, and that was many, many years later, maybe about 30 years later. So yes, it was, people do remember the DLI. Some of the things we, and of course, one of the parades we did there as well, was the, you would get an annual parade to see if you were fit for duty. Prior to us going out to Hong Kong, we'd be inspected. Sorry, prior to going out to Borneo, we were inspected to see, make sure that the battalion was fit to take up the duties to going into Borneo, ensuring that we were fit for purpose. And that was various things which took place, parades, inspections, everything like that. And of course, there was our normal parades, normal guards. But what I remember most about Hong Kong was going out in the new territories on exercise. I don't know if I've spoken about exercise bugle march, where we march 50 miles over the hills, and we used to do our own platoon exercises, and it was more or less, it was just a gelling of everybody, working together. And I remember we did one, the officer still remained nameless, and he was stood on top of Tai Mo Shan, which is the highest point in Hong Kong, and we were doing some march or other, and he stood on the top. We were supposed to go over that way, but we found the shortcut, so we didn't have to go over, and he was on his whistle sending us Morse code telling us to come up and meet him up there, and Margaret, we just kept sending him back, don't understand what you say. What you said, but we got our comeuppance when we got back to barracks.
And prior to going to Borneo, what was the overall health of the battalion?
It was quite good. The exercise that we did, I mean, I ended up in hospital with yellow jaundice, but that was the only time really I was ever really seriously sick. But the battalion, the health was quite good. We had a Sergeant Fox who was in charge of the medical room. I can't remember the name of the doctor because they used to change every so often. But the medical staff, like Sergeant Cox, he was in there all the time. And it was pretty good, the health of the battalion. We had a few. I mean, I wasn't the only one who came down with yellow jaundice. There was a couple of others as well. I don't know what it was. What I remember that was I had two exercises, very 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 hard exercises, and never ever find out what caused the yellow jaundice, even though they did the tests and everything else. And I would consider myself as one of the fittest guys in the battalion, because I actually played football for the battalion, not only for the battalion, but I was in the army football team in Hong Kong, and I was also a boxer. I used to do a lot of other sports, so I was fit. And how I contracted the disease, I don't know.
When you first knew or heard that you were going to Borneo?
We had a visit from General Sir Nigel Port, and he came out to see the battalion, and got the battalion together, and said that it volunteered for Borneo, and we'd never ever spoke about it. We didn't even know that it was going on, if I remember rightly, although at the latter end, to get experience, a platoon actually went to Borneo and was attached to an Irish regiment, I do believe, and of course they came back, and we had one, Mike Bell, who was the signaller who went out to Borneo at the time. But then again, he didn't tell us much, and all we did then was got ourselves all geared up for going to Borneo and looking forward to it. And of course the families were duly packed up round about, I think it was the beginning of October, September, or end of September, beginning of October.
And what year was this?
This was in 1965. And we then prepared, we saw all the families off. I remember going to Kaitak Airport, seeing my wife and two sons. I mean, the youngest one, he was only a few months old, and off they went, back to England, to Colchester, and we then we had various like smokers, what they called smokers in the army, actually in the corporal's mess, sergeant's mess, games, nights and everything else. And at that time I was a lance corporal, and it was a case of then getting the barracks ready to hand over and go to Borneo to do our jungle training.
What were your initial reaction when you heard you were going? I said, obviously you won't ever leave your family.
Excitement, more than anything else.
Had they told you at this point in time that it was an active
service? Oh yes, at that time they told us, and we were given lectures on where we were going and what we were liable to see out there, and that there had been casualties, and to be perfectly honest, I mean, that was one of the reasons why I joined the army, get to see a bit of excitement, and just geared ourselves up to going into Borneo.
And what were the preparations that you were involved in?
Obviously, being in the signals, we sorted all our signals equipment out. Of course, the signals equipment that we had in Hong Kong had to be handed over to the battalion that was taken over from us. And of course, we would be going, if I remember right, I cannot be 100% certain that we went to Borneo and got all our equipment there, but I can't remember 100% whether we took the equipment, but I don't think we did, because normally it was handed over to the battalion that was taken over from you. All the equipment stayed in post, so that you didn't have more equipment to take from point A to point B. So we just got it all ready, and I remember we had Colour Sergeant Brynolf was our colour sergeant, and I must admit he was a guy, and when he handed equipment over it was always 100%, even at the stage of getting knitting needles, cotton wool, Mepo, which is the old Brasso forest, and cleaning all the equipment and points of the radios to make sure they were clean. That was the time, and all radios were scraped down, painted, and renumbered, making sure everything was immaculate before handing them over to the next regiment. He was like that.
So you mentioned jungle training, because you were going to the jungle area. Where did that take place?
That took place in Sarawak. Go from Hong Kong. Once the family had gone, we all prepared. We flew out of Hong Kong to Jesselton in Sabah.
Is this Malaysia?
This is part of this is one of the Malaysian states, which is in the north east part of Borneo Island. Or Sumatra, I think, I'm sure it's Sumatra Island. Anyway, Sabah had its own estate. I mean, the richest man, so they say, the richest man in the world is the king of Sabah. When we arrived in Jesselton, and we flew into Jesselton, and then we went up country to a place called Paradise Camp, where we did our own platoon training. We were fairly acclimatised anyway after 2 years in Hong Kong, and in fact over 2 years in Hong Kong, because we went to Hong Kong in July, August, so we did a little bit longer. So we were acclimatised anyway. and we did our own individual train, make sure all the radio equipment were working. We were going out and doing our own little bits of general train, how to set up the radios and everything else. And of course,
were there any particular problems with your equipment and the jungle? Changes you had to make?
We were issued with the A42 marked, I'm sure it's the A42 radio, which was far superior to the A41, which was the Manpack radio, which was issued to set it down to section level. Down to platoon level. And they had they were finer tuned, which enabled us to have greater distances. We also had the A13, which was the HF radio, which did voice and Morse. And so we were just increasing our knowledge of working in the jungle with radios.
What's the problem of aerials and things? You're surrounded by trees, aren't you?
Well, you are. You're surrounded by dense trees. The A42 was an excellent platoon radio. The increase in size, distance, was quite tremendous. And you had a finer tuning point. Not only that, but on the old A41 radios, you had this continuous mush in your ear all the time. And the new radios, the A42, you could actually tune out the mush, which meant it was better off for in the jungle, because it was silent then. And but the distance and the radio in communications was far superior. And of course we had the A13 HF radio, which was for use in the jungles. There were a man pack and a vehicle station, but mainly for the jungle. The SAS had been using them while they were in Borneo anyway. And of course, they were actually using the A42s as well, which was far superior. But mainly their communication systems was longer distance than what we were in company at 2 Battalion, because they worked in small seconds. So they tended to use the A13 more, because that was the distance really was. But no, we also had, prior to us going out to Borneo, or joining us out in Borneo, we had a Royal Signal section. They had never worked with us before. We'd never had a Royal Signal section attached to us. But they were our communication link once we went into station, into Sarawak. And they were the link between the battalion and brigade headquarters. So we got to know them as well, and we worked with them. And also did patrols in the jungle and did river crossings. We did river crossings on our own. When I say on our own, as a platoon, because we had to become confident, because we still had some non-swimmers. And prior to going out to Borneo, of course, I did the life-saving course, so we were on call all the time, you know. So yes,
this was crossing and swimming over rivers. It wasn't
going across the rivers. There's a particular way of crossing rivers, and again we learnt the hard way. In that the platoon commander decided we had a goggle rope. And it was a piece of wood on one end and two eyelets at the other end. And I'm trying to think how long it would be. It would be about maybe a yard. And maybe a little bit longer. And some people decided, we'll cross the river rope together. And one guy, I remember, he put his toggle... through the eye, he'd put it around his hip, and then put it to another guy. But of course, we didn't realise that when you get into the river, the current becomes very, very swift, took people off the feet, and this particular guy, in fact, Stony Burke is his name, because we still talk about it to this day, and got swept off his feet, toggle rope tightened on him, and he couldn't breathe. And we managed to get everybody out of the river. Fortunately, what I did, I don't know what it was, whether I wouldn't say it was more intelligent of me, but I actually tied a knot, making sure that the rope didn't tighten on me. Anyway, we got everyone out, and you couldn't actually see the rope, which was around his waist. It was bit into his flesh that much. And we all had our pocket knives, all signals we issued with them. And I managed to get my fingers down inside the rope and cut it off without cutting him. And the bruising was fairly severe. At this, we said, there's no way you can cross a river like that. It's all right if it's not deep enough. You can go across up to chest height. But when a river is run swiftly, there's got to be another way. And so what we did, we tied our toggle ropes together. And the platoon commander at that time, and I'll admit to this, so if he ever listens to us, it was me. He tied in and said, right, who's the strongest swimmer? Well, nobody volunteered. So he decided to swim across the river to the other side, tie it on a tree, and then you try the last man, we'll tie it on the tree on the other side, you will go across with the help of the rope. Last man comes across, he ties it around his waist, and he's brought across safely. Anyway, going across the river, I was paying the rope out, and when I went out to commander, got about halfway across or two thirds of the way across, I just held on to the rope, and we had to pull him out because the current was too swift. But I'll hold my hands up to that one.
This was what? Deliberate or yes?
Deliberate.
What was his name?
Can I give his name? Captain Churchill.
So, no doubt he would be a bit upset.
I think so, yes. But anyway, we.
And that became a prescribed method of crossing the river through this place.
That is a proper way,
yeah,
to cross a river. Not tied together. It's just too dangerous. But to cross a river which was which you can't walk across, you have a poncho, and what you do is you put all your equipment into the poncho, tie it up, and you've got a flotation. Because you must, when you're crossing a river, be aware that you can be ambushed at any time. So your equipment was inside the what we call it flotation, your weapon always used to be on top of the flotation, and you would be prepared to actually shoot from where you were, even crossing the river. One or two guys, we issued quite a number of the battalion were issued with Australian airbeds, and what they the non-swimmers would blow up the airbed, have the equipment, their little flotation bag, which is all the rest of the equipment, in the poncho, and cross the river on this little airbed. The only problem is, of course, it took a little bit longer to blow this airbed up for them to go on. But it was the safest way for those, the non-swimmers, because you always had to be prepared for an ambush on the other side. That's why it was always best for the stronger swimmers to go across first, take up a position on the other side to protect the rest of the patrol to cross the river. And that was standard operating procedure.